thank Crunchy, it's still totally tropical and the radio was packed with stories. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol, too warm to sleep, Maureen, and here's what you might have missed.
Yeah, so you've been watching the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games and you've been paying attention closely to the flag bearer because it's your daughter, Kelly, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
How did you feel when you saw her coming out into the stadium?
Ah, it's proud as punch, right? Proud as punch.
Six is an unlucky number in parts of Asia, so your chicken nuggets come in packs of five. You know, I'm probably painting a bad picture of myself here. I have picked up more culturally since I arrived in Tokyo on Tuesday than the fact that there's one less chicken nugget in the box.
We have 1 week when the temperature might reach 30 and we think the whole country is going to melt. Maybe insects and things that fly absolutely love it.
And we'll start with an ode to the weather. Here's Margie Murphy on the live line with Joe and her poem, The Heat Is On.
The heat is on. Oh God, I can't take it, can't do it anymore. I'm lathered in Father 50, but I won't go out the door. Dashing past the windows, living under the stairs. The child of Prague is hysterical, that lad will need his prayers. I'd love a glass of water, but there's nothing in the tap. Hubby's outside cutting trees, we'll suck out the sap. I'd love our normal summer with the wind and the rain, yes. But at least I have the energy to moan and complain. So come on, Met Air, and help us bring the summer we deserve. Some old grey clouds and rain, the heat's not good for me nerves. Thanks, Joe.
Well done, Margie.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Have a good weekend. Bye.
You
bye.
Too.
That's Margie Murphy's poem from The Live Line with Joe Duffy. And the excitement was building in advance of the day's opening ceremony at the Tokyo Olympics. Brenda Irvine, mother of boxer and Team Ireland flag bearer Brendan Irvine, was talking to Gavin Jennings in the morning.
Brenda, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Are you looking forward to today?
I am indeed. I just can't wait to see the opening ceremony.
It's a huge honour for Brendan and a huge honour for you too.
Oh, it is. We're all ecstatic and so proud that he got to be flag bearer along with Kelly because it's history in the making.
He's had a fierce, tough last few years and it's some achievement to make it to the Olympics again. Tell me about his journey to this Olympics.
Well, he won his fight in London, so that qualified him for Tokyo, which was supposed to take place last year. But then, because of lockdown and all, it was all put on hold. But he knew he had qualified to go, but we weren't sure whether it was going to take place because of the pandemic and stuff. But luckily, it is going ahead, like.
That must have been very hard from waiting to find out.
Oh, it was, yeah, definitely. Like, I think all the teammates, because they worked so hard and trained so hard to get to where they were, they actually qualify.
And he's had to battle with injury in the last 2 years too.
Yes, just before the World Championships, he had a freak accident in the ring where he broke part of his foot, so he was in a boot. And he was in that for a long time, but it didn't stop him training because he was working on his upper body strength and sticking to that and training every day.
Have you been talking to him the last 2 days? How is he?
He's fine, so he is. He's completely overwhelmed that he's flag bearer along with Kelly. We've known Kelly a long time from the National Stadium from Dundown when he was entering for different competitions and that.
Yeah, it's a huge honour for both of them. And we were reporting earlier, Brenda, that Portland Road, that's the street where Kelly Harrington is from in Dublin, that it's decked out in banners for today and for the Games. What about where you are?
There's banners everywhere. The support he has here has been phenomenal. We just can't believe it. Like, it's just like living a dream at the minute. And especially for him, because he has been through so much with injury and stuff. just to give him that wee boost to know that people are behind him.
I know you're very proud of him, but are you able to watch his fights?
No. I'm one of the mummies that I'll be pacing the floors while the rest of them are watching. I'll watch them all afterwards, like, but not at the time.
Well, that's Brenda Irvine, mother of Olympic boxer Brendan Irvine. Then later, Damien O'Mara was talking to Oliver Callan from the RTE studio in Tokyo.
Konnichiwa, how are you?
Very well, thank you. You're an Olympics veteran in many ways, aren't you? You had, was it London 2012? You got the Rio. I mean, they're the best gigs to do as a sports guy, I presume. So you must have, you must have spent the last couple of years going, yes, Tokyo, I'm going to see all of Tokyo. It's going to be dream come true.
And instead, it's like, it's akin to people that went to Italy for the World Cup and missed the World Cup because they were in Italy. There's almost a sense with us that we've come to Japan and we've missed it because we're at the Olympics. Because as you can imagine, it is, there's quite a lot of protocol and a lot of factors that have been impacted upon by COVID. So, yeah, you mentioned, now, to be honest with you, I would never lay claim to being a veteran. I'm here with colleagues who were on their eighth, I think we've seventh, eighth and ninth time Olympians.
Yes.
Amongst the small group of us that's here. But from having been in London, having been in Rio and now here in Tokyo, this is unlike anything that any of us have ever experienced before and hopefully will ever experience again.
Is the mood like, is it bad? Is it grim?
No, not at all. No, I think... I think a lot of us who came over here, we knew what we were going to deal with. We knew what we were going to expect. And I think it's, I don't want to quite make it out that it's almost like Band of Brothers for everyone that's in here. But we're in here. Everyone knows what the restrictions are. But you're still, you've touched upon it. You are still here at what is undoubtedly the greatest sporting spectacle in the world. Mm. And, you know, there will have been debates and debates will continue over as to whether or not this should go ahead at all. But we're still here with... You know, the greatest sporting feats that we will bear witness to this year will probably play out in Tokyo over the coming weeks. So, I wouldn't say it's grim. It's different. It's, you know, we have an awful lot of, like, we can talk a little bit if you want about the daily testing and the protocols that are in place, the restrictions that are in place.
Yeah.
It's probably, it will be the Olympics without the bit of crack along the way. You know, they're long days, they're hard days, but it's still, I've been paraphrasing probably incorrectly Murray Harney to people over the last couple of weeks that it's akin to your toughest day in government is still better than your best day in opposition. And I think for a lot of us here, we would rather be here putting up with it than being at home watching it on television or listening to it on the radio.
That's a good point. So, I mean, how, like, because you're being shuffled from the hotel basically to the Olympic Village and to the events each day. Is that the idea? And you have to be tested every day.
Yeah, so we're effectively operating within an Olympic bubble. So there is no public transport. There's no public dining. Restrictions can lift potentially after your 14th day in Tokyo or in Japan. Effectively we had an awful lot of stuff to do in advance of leaving Dublin. PCR tests 96 and 72 hours out. You then have to get a official Japanese immigration form issued to you, a specific COVID form. You then arrive, you're antigen tested in the airport, which in some cases, some of our colleagues had in excess of 6 hours in the airport, having travelled from Dublin, waiting for their antigen tests to come back. We do an antigen test ourselves every day, which is submitted to testing here in the International Broadcast Center where we are operating from. So yeah, effectively, no public dining, no public transport. We're allowed 15 minutes to go to a convenience store, and we're signed in and out of the hotel by an official who's in the lobby of the hotel. So we have we've two shops very like within. Literally, one is in the basement of the hotel. One is two doors down. And aside from that, you get on either official Olympic transport or Olympic approved transport to the venues, and you go home again. Even in the evenings, we have there is a preferred catering supplier or one of the takeaway companies, the apps on your phone. And you get your dinner delivered to the lobby of the hotel and you go back to your room and eat it on your own.
So there's no, okay, so there's no restaurant in the hotel or anything. So there's no, none of the kind of water cooler journalism kind of effect that you can all hang out together.
The giving out and moaning that we all do when we're together in the lobby of a hotel. No, and come here. I don't want this to sound like, oh, these poor creators are in Tokyo and they're living the hard life. This is what we signed up for. These are the parameters that have been put in place in order for the IOC and the people that are involved, at the, you know, the local organising committee, the medical advisors that they have, to put on a safe Games. And if that's to be the case, then I think the vast majority of people are, that are here are happy to subscribe to that. And we all knew, like I said to you previously, we all knew what it was we were signing up for. So we're all here and we're going to make the most of it and we're going to enjoy every minute of it.
And Damien isn't much of a sushi person.
I'll be honest with you, I wouldn't be a sushi man myself. I've hit a few ramen places along the way. And then you know how it is. You arrive back to the hotel late at night and you've had a long day and you look at the delivery, the expected delivery times, and then you just end up falling straight back into like McDonald's or Domino's or whatever it is you know you can get in a relatively quick period of time. There must be an army of delivery drivers who stay outside the fast food joints because they are consistently the places that will deliver to you quickest.
So you've gone for the McDonald's. Is it the same? Is it the same as here?
It's the exact same. And you know that the great benefit of it is, Oliver, as you will understand, my Japanese wouldn't be great. I've used, in saying konnichiwa, I've used 50% of the Japanese words that I've managed to pick up so far. I'm going to hold on to the other one for the end of the conversation.
What is the other one? Always for the end of it. Well, okay, I see where you're coming from.
No, it's not sayonara. Actually, I've got three words. I've used a third of my words. I've now used 66% of my words. It's the exact same. And thankfully, McDonald's, it's all in pictures. So, you know, you can just click on the pictures and you know exactly what you're getting.
Right. Is there something odd about their chicken selects? Because you get six, don't you?
You only get five over here. Six is an unlucky number in parts of Asia, so your chicken nuggets come in packs of five.
Wow.
I'm probably painting a bad picture of myself here. I have picked up more culturally since I arrived in Tokyo on Tuesday than the fact that there's one less chicken nugget in the box.
Okay. We're getting a real flavour for Tokyo here so far. But that's the thing, isn't it? You're not going to be able to get out and about in the city. I mean, would you normally be able, you'd soak up the atmosphere, wouldn't you, in an Olympic, and be excited about it?
To compare them to other games, like when you went to London, the entire city was completely bought into the Olympics. And you had a sense from the minute you arrived in Heathrow Airport and from the every moment you stepped out into the streets of London, you knew there was something really significant going on. And that's away from the fact that the place was branded with an inch of its life. Rio was slightly different insofar as there was considerable opposition amongst people in Rio and the Brazilian economy was in a particularly bad place at the time. The fact that we're operating within the bubble, it does limit what you can do. And, you know, it is going to be that situation of having come to Tokyo and having not had the opportunity to fully avail of the hospitality that they have on offer. But I have to say that the welcome we've got from people has been phenomenal. And I know there is opposition in some quarters to the games going ahead. There's an awful lot of people will question why in the middle of a global pandemic brought 11,000 athletes from over 200 countries to one city in order to see them compete. But you do get a sense from the volunteers you meet, from the people that we interact with in the hotel, the drivers that you might meet along the way, that, you know, they are really the people that we have dealt with, they are really happy to see it. It's a big opportunity for them. And, you know, albeit one that is taking place against the backdrop of concerns about the impact on COVID and the fact that, you know, Tokyo in the last couple of days have registered three of the single largest days of cases that they've had in quite some time. Now, the mm-hmm. Olympics would argue that the cases linked to people that have come into the Olympics themselves have just, I think it's just nudged over 100 people since the start of this week. So, you know, the IOC and the health officials would say, you know, okay, the cases have ratcheted up, but it's not necessarily as a direct result of the Olympics landing into town.
And Oliver mentioned some of Team Ireland's athletes.
And we have some great hopefuls, don't we? We've got, people remember the O'Donovan brothers, they're coming, of course, a bit differently now because there's only one of the O'Donovans this time.
The lineups have been changed, but like we can debate whether or not it's unfair for us to measure success purely in terms of medals. That I know ultimately at the end of the, at the end of the Olympics, people are going to sit down and say Ireland won X number of medals and they won Y number of medals in Rio. So this is either a more successful or a less successful game. But I think you've touched upon Sunita Pushpura went in her heat was I'm loath to use the word dominant, but it's the word that comes to mind time and time again. Like she absolutely blew away the competition to win her heat overnight. She was the first of the Irish athletes in action. Disappointment for Philip Doyle and Ronan Byrne in their heat in the men's double sculls in the rowing. But like Sunita Pushpura is a double world champion, multiple European champion. She's a very strong medal hope. I'm going to see Reese McClenaghan in the gymnastics tomorrow. He's been really bullish in terms of like I'm here to win gold. And you know, I think Kelly Harrington, who'll be the flag bearer at the opening ceremony this evening, has a very, very strong chance. And
there are
you know,
two great characters. They're two great personalities as well, aren't they? To get behind.
Oh, but there's multiple. Like, it's, you know, and I think that's part of the beauty of this is that you will just look at, you know, there will be a star that will come from, I don't want to say from nowhere, but there is somebody who will become a household name to Irish people over the next couple of weeks that they perhaps may have heard of but might not necessarily have known an awful lot of previously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the O'Donovans were definitely that last time round. You know, Kelly Harrington is such an infectious character. I think if, and we hope she does, progresses to the final, I think she'll effectively bring the curtain down on Ireland's participation at the Games on the final day on the 8th of August. And I think anyone who's ever had dealings with her, it's very hard to walk away from having spoken to her without having a smile on your face and without feeling immensely positive about things. So, but for Kelly Harrington, there's 10, 15, 20 other people likewise. You know, you've got the hockey squad who did great things in the World Cup a couple of years ago are here to make history for their sport. The first time a women's hockey team will compete for Ireland at the Olympic Games. And there are multiple athletes who will make history for their sport and for their communities and for their families and for their counties and for everything else over the coming weeks. It's really, for me, had you told me, like I was 11 watching Michael Carruth in Barcelona in 92, had you told me that I'd get to see one Olympics, let alone three Olympics, I would take the arm off you. So I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into it over the coming weeks.
Damien O'Mara talking to Oliver Callan in the morning. Then later in the afternoon, Christy Harrington, father of boxer and flag bearer for Team Ireland, Kelly Harrington.
Yeah, so you've been watching the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games and you've been paying attention closely to the flag bearer for the Irish team. Well, half it anyway, because it's your daughter, Kelly, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
How did you feel when you saw her coming out into the stadium?
Oh, it's proud as punch, right? Proud as punch, just a dream come true, you know?
Yeah. Well, you must be very proud of her anyway, because she's just such a wonderful human being. Having met her so many times, she's just such a lovely person, your daughter.
She, the last time you met her, she was a world champion, now she's an Olympian.
Yeah. And, like, this, I don't, like, I suppose as a dad, you're going, that's okay, daughter, love, whatever you call her. You've gone to the world championship, whatever happens next doesn't matter. And then she goes and she's going to the Olympics. And not only that, but she's carrying the Irish flag out into the stadium, which is, that's monumental, isn't it?
That's magic. As you say, that's the icing on the cake. That's what we're all saying, you know?
Great picture in the Irish Times today of Portland Row. And Kitty Holland got to talk to you. You were sitting out reading the paper. What were you reading about?
Do you know what I was actually reading about? The kickboxer or the taekwondo lad.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Woolly. We had him on.
Yeah, he's a great chap.
He's a lovely guy. Great attitude. A bit like Kelly. Just great attitude.
Great attitude.
And you're very sort of, she says, sanguine. Now, I'll have to look that up. She says you were very sanguine when asked, did you think Kelly would win a medal? You replied, every athlete over there wants that gold medal. What's to be will be. And then you broke into song, que sera, sera. No, you didn't. So what's the atmosphere down there? Everyone has the Irish flags out?
You all have to know. I was only out 2 minutes ago, right? And a man passed away and he says, she had us in tears.
Yeah.
Isn't that unbelievable?
Isn't it? Yeah.
So we've, from kids from 3 years of age, from people to 90, talking about her and asking about her. It's unbelievable.
And because it's been such a long time coming, and because the world is on tenterhooks because of the pandemic and the lockdown, it just heightens everybody's emotions, I think. Doesn't it, Christy?
Say it again, right? I can't hear you properly.
It sort of heightens everybody's emotions. That's why that man cried, probably.
Yeah,
yes, it's just so it's the world we live in at the moment, isn't it? When was the last time you spoke to Kelly?
About 2 weeks ago.
All right, that's the last time.
Because she's in total focus now. She's really focused, yeah.
That's because she's not rude, because I dropped her a text the other day when I heard she was going to be the flag bearer and she didn't get back to me. So I understand completely. She's in total lockdown.
Exactly.
When's her first fight, Christy?
On the 30th.
Right.
And it's at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right. What's the plan for that?
We just got up, we set the alarm and we go up and watch it.
Yeah. And you would go to see Kelly fighting in Ireland, but you've never travelled outside the country.
Yeah, but we wouldn't have went to the Olympics.
Would you not?
No.
Just no desire to go. No want.
No. We just watch her. She'll do us all proud.
Yeah.
Well, and you know what it is, right? And Annie would have loved this. She's a Kildare woman, same as yourself.
Oh, is she? Yes.
Yeah.
And how long is she dead, Christy?
She'd be dead about 7 years now.
Right.
She loved the Olympics, and any excuse to put their buttons and flags out.
Right. Yeah.
And she had a Kildare flag, and she never got a reason to put one out. I mean, she didn't care. What was it for, Ray?
What was it for?
To put me dad's coffin.
The which?
To put me dad's coffin.
Oh, right.
That's the only time she could use it. It's a lot mad, isn't it?
that's pretty. Yeah. It's like, it was years ago, Christy. We were on Blackboard Jungle, and one of the questions was in the sports section. One of the questions was, when was the last time Kildare won the All Ireland final? You see, so I asked it, and your man got it wrong, or whatever. And then I was in a pub a few days after, and he says, this guy comes up to me. He says, I was watching Blackboard Jungle the other day. He says, you asked the question there, you know. When was the last time Kildare won the All Ireland? I've a bone to pick with you over that. That wasn't a sports question, that was a history question. Our day will come.
Oh, yeah, eventually, yeah.
So what are you hoping for Kelly in the Olympics?
I don't even know how to explain it, Ray. Just.
That she does her best, I suppose. Yeah, that she does her best.
That she comes back happy. That's
yes,
the main thing.
Yeah, yeah. And she'll know that she's done her best, won't she?
That's it.
I don't know if you noticed this, or you probably were aware that it was going to happen, but a lot of people spotted that Ireland were out earlier than they normally would be. And the reason is that it's going by the Japanese alphabet.
Yeah.
And in Japan, Ireland is referred to as Iru-Randu.
Right.
And it begins with an A.
As opposed to
an I. So it shoved us up the running order, so to speak. And that's why Kelly was out first with Brendan. With Brendan, yeah. So there you go. Well, listen, great to talk to you, Christy. And if you're speaking to Kelly at any stage, say good luck from all of us. And the whole country's behind her.
He's just so proud of her. That's Kelly Harrington's dad, Christy, on The Ray D'Arcy Show. And in the morning, Claire Byrne was talking to Stephen Kenny.
Stephen Kenny, Republic of Ireland, senior men's football manager. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Claire. How
Thanks
are you
for
doing?
Coming in. It's good to see you. It feels like no time since the Euros ended. It's no time, really. You were at some of the games that had 15,000 people in the stadium, 60,000 fans. You're in Wembley, weren't you, for the semi-final. What was the experience like being there in a stadium with fans?
Yeah, and really Budapest was the biggest experience, really, because you went from sort of nothing, not been any fans at games or very few, to I went to Munich to see Germany and Portugal, which was a terrific game in front of 15,000 in the Allianz Arena in Munich. But Budapest was 62,000. There wasn't a spare seat. That was a full house, a full house. And that was amazing to see that. And
was it a bit nerve-wracking as well, because we're so acclimatized now, aren't we, to not being beside people?
Yeah, everyone had to have a PCR test or proof of it. So that's the way it was done. And it was 2-2 Portugal and France. Just a great game, brilliant atmosphere. And it really captured the imagination. It was just a terrific terrific environment.
Did it remind you, though, about what we've been missing out on? And in particular, I'm thinking about the players, you know, our own team.
Yeah, so very much so, because we've given 13 players their competitive debut over the last in the last season, and yet none of them have actually experienced. Like, they dream about playing for Ireland, walking out into a full stadium, representing their country,
with the roar of the crowd.
Yeah, exactly, and they've not experienced that. So this is for them coming into this September window. Although it's not full house, it's the start of a chapter for them, experiencing the Irish support.
And what did you think of England's run to the final, Gareth Southgate's management style? I mean, there was some criticism of him, certainly earlier on, you know, about the defensive style that they were playing. What did you make of how he handled the whole thing?
England have an outstanding squad, really. You know, they've got great attacking options, and they were unfortunate. I think overall, you'd have to say Italy particularly earlier in the tournament and overall deserved it on the night as well to win the Euros. But England, yeah, Gareth Southgate obviously did a very good job, semi final and a final in two tournaments. But the
you seem unsure about him now, as I ask you.
No, not unsure at all. I'm just saying, like, you know, probably France were the favourites probably overall, and they went out in a shock result, really, with a 3-1 up. France, really. Belgium were high expectations with Belgium. Portugal were the European, current European champions, and they had, a lot of attacking options. So England were amongst that. They had terrific talent, England, attacking talent. But Italy, not so much attacking talent in comparison to those other countries, but maximised everything they had, and they did amazing, really, to win the tournament.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because when England scored the goal in the final early on, that was just lockdown defence after that, wasn't it?
That was the approach that they adopted, a counter-attacking approach, and certainly Italy, to be fair to England, I think their European Championship assault, if you like, was based on a sound defence. They never conceded hardly in the tournament, and they only conceded one goal, and then in the final, obviously from a set play, Bonucci scored. So it was a pivotal moment.
Listen, I want to talk to you about Christian Eriksen, his collapse on the field with the heart condition, because after that you spoke for the first time about what happened to you. You spoke publicly about what happened in 2019 after that game against Sweden, when you were in Sweden, and your own health scare. What's been the response been like since you said that publicly?
I don't know, people are supportive, but it was the impact of seeing, not so much myself, but the effect of people around Christian Eriksen that prompted me to speak on that, because when I visually seen it myself, it was a bit of a shock, because the impact it had on the other Danish players, the staff, just the general public. So for me, obviously it happened in an airport in Sweden, in Glasgow Airport. So to see the impact it had on my staff and how supportive they were. And when I say staff, I mean colleagues and friends.
Yeah.
They were outstanding.
So,
you know?
So when you saw what happened to Christian Eriksen, did you have a realisation, look, the people around me might have been really badly affected by this, and I need to acknowledge that?
Well, I spoke to them after the Eriksen incident and individually, and just wondered about, you know, the impact on them, and you know, it was quite traumatic at the time for them. So that was it. But we've all moved on, and I've moved on. You know, it was one of those things. You know, I feel brilliant. I'm absolutely in full health, and I'm flying, you know, in relation to everything. So but just at the time, it was difficult for the people around me. Like at the time, Keith Andrews, Damien Doyle, Colm O'Neill, Jim Crawford, all these people. Fergus McNally, all these people who were around at the time, Kevin Mulholland, all of the coaches, lucky enough, the players were gone through onto the flight at the time, you know.
And you have a pacemaker now as a result of that.
Yeah, I do, yeah. Got fit in Sweden, so I was in hospital in Sweden for a week, and, you know, it's not a complicated procedure, I'm running most mornings. It's not invasive at all. It's worked out well.
And this was a congenital thing that you had, where your heart missed a beat.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that had never been detected. And it was just the lack of electroactivity to my heart at the time. And that caused that. So
you spoke as well about waking up in the ambulance and saying that you had to be at your wife's graduation the next day.
Well, she's fun. Yeah, she sacrificed so much for me, really. So I suppose the fact that she actually done something for herself, and I went and ruined it in dramatic circumstances.
In going back to college.
Absolutely, yeah. It was her graduation. So, yeah, so she flew out to Sweden and spent a week there. Mm-hmm.
And Claire asked Stephen Kenny about the online abuse and racism that young players have to endure.
Listen, it is. We've seen different strands of it. Like, we obviously, we've seen James McLean, you know.
Yeah, we spoke to him here and his wife, actually, about what's been happening to them.
Listen, I signed James as a 16-year-old at 30, you know, and I had him for 4 or 5 years. I sold him to Sunderland. I was at his wedding. So I know him quite well. Shane Duffy, you know, they um, he had a lot of stuff this year. And then the racial stuff, which has been absolutely disgraceful. Young players in the under-21s getting racial abuse and stuff like that. But, it's for governments really to make decisions on that.
What do you tell the players who get that abuse?
Well, you know, it's... you tell them not to go onto social media, not to engage in it, but of course they do, you know, and that's only natural, and it's very difficult for them to deal with. But I think, you know, they have to become immune to it, and that's you can never be immune to it, but you just do your utmost to sort of block it out. But I think it's some of the stuff in the stadiums that you see in Europe as well, and you know that that's to me that's even worse. You know, and you know, your wife have a big job, stopping sort of racial abuse in stadiums throughout Europe. That's because that's really upfront and in your face and blatant. Mm-hmm. You know, someone can hide behind a pseudonym on social media, but actually, so in stadiums throughout Europe, there should be greater sanctions to countries or clubs. Yeah, much greater sanction.
So if you advise your players not to look at social media, do you take that advice yourself?
I'm not on social media. I don't have a presence. I never had. I've never had.
We can all have a snoop, even if we don't have a presence.
No. I do get informed of stuff, but like, you know, certainly, you know, and but listen. That's... You know, I have to, just focus on the task in hand and try not to get distracted.
You mentioned abuse in the stadiums from fans and some of the England fans booing their own players for taking the knee.
Well, it was strange, and particularly it came from government level as well, where, Priti Patel, back to people who booed, you know, which was...
Boris Johnson said he was more focused on action rather than gestures, meaning that taking the knee was just a gesture.
I don't agree with that. We had that ourselves in Hungary where the players took the knee and of course, they were booed in Budapest and, you know, the Prime Minister actually backed the stance and, you know, I don't get that, you know, and there needs to be leadership from the highest levels of government.
Mm-hmm. You've no issue with your players taking the knee, in other words.
Oh, I absolutely backed them. Yeah, I absolutely backed them. I think it's, I don't see it as a political gesture. You know, I think it's humanitarian, and I think it's to just, you know, if they want to do it, I'm completely behind that.
Okay, but... Politics and sport has been mixing, though, hasn't it? I mean, you see Marcus Rashford, what he's been doing, his activism in the UK. Tyrone Mings, he publicly criticised the Tory government. And Priti Patel, for the reasons that you mentioned there. Do you think that they should never mix, or are you okay with what's been happening?
No. Well, it's always been intertwined in some way, going back to all of the Olympic Games throughout the years and going through... You know, you can never divorce the two, and there's no doubt that that it is a factor.
Stephen Kenny from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, after five drowning tragedies on the island, warnings about water safety for the coming sunny weekend.
And this morning's news means that five people have now drowned on the island of Ireland in the past week. On Wednesday night, 29-year-old Natasha Corr drowned in Swan Lake in County Cavan while trying to help one of her children in the water. Also this week, Michael Hoey, a man aged in his 70s, died after getting into difficulty in Spencer Harbour in County Leitrim. 55-year-old Peter Jones drowned in Loch Melvin in Fermanagh. And 13-year-old Jay Moffat drowned in a lake in Scarva in County Down. Let's speak to Gerard O'Flynn. He's operations manager of the Irish Coast Guard. Gerard O'Flynn, good morning. Thanks for taking our call today.
Good morning.
With the warm weather of the past week, lots more people are getting into water, and sadly five people now have been lost.
Yeah, well, at the outset, on behalf of the Coast Guard, we obviously want to extend our sympathy to the friends and relatives and colleagues of the people who sadly lost their lives this week. What we're finding in the Coast Guard, and it, I guess, is entirely predictable, is that the number of incidents that we've been involved in this year is much higher than recent years. In fact, in year-to-date, our total number is something like 1,690, whereas the corresponding last year was 1,340. So that gives a sense of the growth in activity. Obviously, the reasons are very obvious. The excellent weather, which everybody is enjoying, and obviously the restriction on other recreational activities due to the ongoing COVID restrictions. But we have a group in Ireland of perhaps we might call them the SAR stakeholder family, includes Water Safety Ireland, RNLI, Metairn, BIM, Irish Sailing, etc. And we've identified three areas that we think are worthy of mention. One is the use of jet skis, and we would appeal to all users of jet skis to be sensitive to areas where people are swimming. The other one is the growth in open water swimming, which is an all-year-round activity now. But because of that, people swim longer distances. So we'd appeal to all swimmers never to swim alone. Make sure that your activity is being observed. And if possible, if you're swimming more offshore or longer distance, to make sure you're visible, use a tow flow or wear a cap. And the other area, and perhaps the most important one, is we would ask people never, ever, ever to use inflatable toys in open water, be it on the coast, you know, on the sea, on lakes or on rivers. But inflatable toys is an area that is of particular concern.
Gerard, what is a tow float?
Say that again.
A tow float, you mentioned there.
Oh, sorry, it's just a little device that you attach to your body, to your foot, and you tow along with you, and it's a highly visible device, and by using that, you can be observed, and you're just more visible in the water.
It's UN World Drowning Prevention Day on Sunday. Is that a first?
That's the first time, and it's being actively promoted by in Ireland, and it's drawing attention to the huge tragedy attached, or the huge number of drownings worldwide. It came on foot of a UN resolution earlier this year, and there is it's being very well promoted in Ireland, and it's quite, I suppose, significant given what has happened in Ireland this week, to highlight just the simple tragedy of people who are generally engaging in recreation and suddenly get into difficulty and lose their lives. So it is a first, and it's being actively promoted. And there is a very good website on it. You can go to watersafetyireland.ie or where there is a dedicated website. But it is a very timely reminder of the risk attached or the risk and the tragedy attached to drowning and loss of life.
What advice would you offer to people, many of whom will take to the water this weekend?
Well, keep it simple. Obviously, there are a number of key things. If possible, swim in lifeguarded areas or swim in areas that are being used by other people. Never to swim alone. Make sure that your activity is being observed by colleagues or by somebody ashore. Make sure that if you are going swimming, that people know when to expect you back. But I suppose the simplest and most important thing is, if at all possible, swim in lifeguarded areas or in areas that are commonly used, and make sure that your activity is being observed either by colleagues in the water or somebody ashore.
Gerard O'Flynn of the Irish Coast Guard talking to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland. And in the morning, Oliver Callan was talking to singers and presenters of the RTE series The Heart of Saturday Night, Una Healy and Loa.
Una Healy and Loa, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Very well. And Una Healy, who I just picture Tipperary just saying your name, Una. So, but this show, it's filmed in the round room of Dublin's Mansion House. This is like a dream gig for you, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. For both of us, myself and Loa are just in our element there. You can see us. We're beaming through the screens because we're like, not only are we like, you know, just celebrating music, but we actually get to sing ourselves as well. And it's just celebrating the great Irish music of today and the past as well. It's just one big celebration of music and Irish music. It really is an amazing show, and I just can't wait for everyone to see it. And so that's why it's on for 6 weeks, so you'll be greatly entertained every Saturday night.
No, it sounds brilliant. You obviously, when was the last time you would have performed in front of any? I know it's crew and other musicians, but performing the first day must have been an emotional experience.
It was, yeah. I think for everybody, a lot of people said this is like the first time that I've actually performed in front of an audience, essentially in a room. I hadn't done a gig, and I haven't since it's nearly 2 years now. So it was, it's amazing to be back on stage. Yeah, and Loa, you missed it as well, didn't you, a lot?
Yeah, oh, it was so exciting to be back, wasn't it? And we had so much crack on set, and obviously it was really emotional for everyone because everyone's feeling the same thing and just so loving being around other musicians. It was like a mini session in our very giant house, and it was just great to be back. And I think that everyone watching it is really going to enjoy that too, because I think that we've all been missing it.
And Loa, what kind of vibe can we expect then from tomorrow night?
Well, tomorrow night, we're starting with a bang. We've got Codaline, we've got Lyra, and Gavin James. And I have the great honour of singing a song with Gavin and singing another one on my own. So it's going to be very fun and light and beautiful.
Great. And do you get to sit down and have a chat with some of them?
Yes. I chat to Gavin and Codaline, and Una, you chatted to Lyra, is that right?
Yeah, I was chatting to Lyra as well. Yeah, it was lovely. We actually were, like as Laura was saying there, we're in the mansion house. Like, it's kind of like it was our living room, you know, having the chats on the sofa and then just getting to like sit back and relax and enjoy and watch the others perform. Actually, I remember Bellex when I overheard them saying as well, it's just like doing a gig in front of your peers, like, you know. but it's lovely. Like, yeah, and it's such an amazing production company as well, the same creators of Other Voices. So like I myself like grew up watching that, and I used to like, you know, being when I was doing the pub scene, singing in bars, closing my eyes, pretending I was on Other Voices. And so this is a massive dream come true for me to be performing amongst these people, and Loa as well is on Other Voices as well. So yeah, it's like, it's amazing.
So it's all Irish, yeah, and it's Irish, Irish. How many references to Tip do you manage to crowbar in?
Oh, I just like randomly shout up Tip every now and then. So often after that.
And Loa, you have an interesting background because you were a qualified pharmacist.
Yes.
And then you turned musician, but obviously.
And then I went back.
Yeah, because you had big plans for last year before it all, before everything went kaput.
Yeah, before it all went haywire, I was actually going to emigrate to the States, and you know, the day that I was planning to fly out was the day we went into lockdown, the 16th of March, day before Paddy's Day 2020, a day we'll all remember forever. So I ended up going back to my old job, and I've been there since. And, you know, things have, in some ways, while it's been very challenging not to do live gigs, they've taken off for me in the sense that I did that work with Other Voices, and I've managed to keep myself really busy and write. So in a way, maybe it's been a kind of a blessing in disguise, because I've had a really improved relationship with being in Ireland and working here. So yeah.
You grew up in Kildare.
I did.
Is it in Kildare you're still based?
No, I'm in Dublin now. I'm in the Big Smoke.
Traitor to the Kildare people. But it was fronting those streaming shows, wasn't it, that's led to this gig?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you were speaking about Other Voices earlier with Amy Winehouse and everything. They make really incredible music shows and really tasteful. And so we have I have a relationship with them the last couple of years. And yeah, I presented two of the shows and sang. So it kind of all worked out in this really lovely, organic way. And then meeting Una has been such a blessing, and we got on so well as well. And you know, we're similar. We have our own backgrounds, but we have like a very funny Venn diagram and stuff. So it's it really feels like a special synchronicity.
And Una, you got to know Loa as well through the Irish Women in Harmony project.
Yeah, that's right. There was another, you know, something good that came out of the pandemic, I guess, like bringing people together. Although we were at home, the whole thing was recorded from home, and Ruth Ann Cunningham set the whole thing up. And yeah, I was so delighted to be part of that. And I didn't know Loa before, but I listened to her music and I was such a big fan of her voice. It's absolutely gorgeous. You should hear her on the show. She's unbelievable. She really is. Mm. But yeah, that was a lovely project to work on during the pandemic, and we still are in touch all the time with the girls. Mm. It's a really fantastic thing.
Una Healy and Loa, the heart of Saturday night begins this weekend on RTÉ1 TV. They were talking to Oliver Callan in the morning. And in the afternoon on the Ray Darcy Show, Éanann Ní Leabhar was talking about the insects and spiders in summer.
Listen, first stop, earwigs. There was somebody up in the office spotted a tweet from a poor woman whose six-year-old spotted an earwig, and the six-year-old says, "I heard that earwigs go into your ears." And the mother said, "No, they don't," but her inner child was saying, "They go into your ear and burst your eardrum." And now there's a myth and a half, isn't it?
That's right, and they eat all your brains because there's very carnivorous earwigs around the place. This is the complete rubbish, as you know very well. Yes. Earwigs eat flowers. So unless you have your ear drum full of flower petals, they are not going to eat, go into your ear or eat your eardrums or any other blinking thing. That's all a big codswallop, because the name earwig is a corruption of a different word altogether, which isn't probably fit for broadcast.
Right.
You know, there's a bird called the wheat ear. And it has nothing to do with wheat or ears. This bird has a white rump.
Aha.
And its word of it name originally was the white arse.
Aha.
And then it became a white ear, and then it became a wheat ear.
So it's an arsewig,
so
is it?
The ear
an
arsewig,
right, okay.
Yeah, an arsewig, because the wig at the bottom covered its tail end, the two pincers.
Ah, there you go. Now, explain that to your six-year-old, you'll
but
be fine.
But you couldn't be saying that on the wireless, so...
No, but it'll be
and
a bit...
And, of course, they should have called it a rear wig, I suppose.
Yes, a rear wig. Now... unnaturally, of course they're not unnatural, but like very unusual temperatures this week. So how does that affect our bug population?
We have one week when the temperature might reach 30 and we think the whole country is going to melt. I mean, insects and things that fly absolutely love it.
Right.
I mean, it rains if you're a bee and it's raining and the rain drops and you're half the size of yourself. It's like being out in a huge shower of terrible hailstones. So insects fly in the sunshine. They need to fly in order to meet members of the opposite sex with a view to forming liaisons. So the butterflies are out in force, the bees are out in force, the dragonflies are out in force. And other summers when we had rain all during July, this wouldn't happen because they couldn't fly in the rain. So it's good news for those kind of creatures who are delighted to be out and about looking for nectar and being at singles party, really. So
yeah.
If you're in your garden looking at your buddleia bush or your nice flowers there, lovely lavenders, you'll see all these insects delighted with themselves in the sunshine. So it's good news for those creatures.
I was looking out this morning and I saw a magpie chase a butterfly around the garden. Now, luckily for the butterfly, he wasn't successful.
Magpies don't chase anything.
Would they? Yes.
It's a change from the cat, I suppose, to be chasing the butterflies.
So magpies
would eat it.
Would they? Yeah. It's hard to know. Would it
I have magpies that eat anything they can get there. They can get their beaks around. But the butterfly obviously fluttered off and escaped with any luck, I suppose.
Yeah. I've developed a lovely sort of relationship with butterflies. They tend to lead me when I'm out running because you interrupt them and then they just fly ahead of you. And now in my head, they're sort of leading the way. That's not the case at all. But with this weather, we would see more butterflies out and about.
We would definitely. Don't tell me you're out running in this heat. You're mad. But anyway, the butterflies, they're actually doing a survey of butterflies at the moment to see have we more butterflies this year than last year, the National Biodiversity Centre, and we'll be talking about that next week on the Mooney Show.
Right.
But the 9 or 10 most common butterflies that you see in your garden, you're asked to look at these and send them into the Biodiversity Centre. And they actually have a guide to this on the centre if you press the button. So the small tortoise shell and the speckled woods, they're all out at the moment. Those lovely orange ones with blue dots on them are the tortoise shells. And then you might get the Red Admiral, that lovely one that's black and white and red. Gorgeous one. And that's a migrant one that comes here in the summertime. So there's loads of those around at the moment. And I'm sure the ones you see when you're out running include several white ones as well, because we have 4 different or even 5 different species of white butterfly, and they're flying at this time of the year as well. So we only have about 35 species, and there's probably only about 15 of them that are very common. So they're a group that you could actually get to know. I mean, in the winter time you're doing the garden birds, so now in the summertime you can do the garden butterflies. Something else to be doing.
What about the little blue ones? They're the ones I'm most fond of.
Well, the blue ones, there's 2 blue ones. There's the holly blue, which is the one you get in the city because the first ones lay their eggs on holly and the second ones lay their eggs on ivy. There's two goes of them. So the first group were out earlier in the year and then we'll have them coming again later on towards the end of August. And then you have the other ones, the common blues, which you get by the seaside because they like alkaline soil. So if you're running along an Esker Ridge or somewhere where there's flowers growing, because where they occur is where their food plant is. And each butterfly butterfly species has a particular food plant to lay its eggs on. They don't just lay them on any old grass or anything going by. They have a specific plant that they lay their eggs on, and that's what determines where you actually find them. So you tend to get your common blues where you have alkaline conditions where their food plant will grow the birds for trefoil, whereas the other one, the holly blue, is in city gardens where there's holly and ivy growing, and there's lots of that around as well.
Isn't nature wonderful? We were speaking to Professor Sweeney about climate change earlier in the week. So what about our fauna when it comes to, you know, because we will have more weeks like this. It will become more common as in the future. So is that going to change what we'll see around us when it comes to birds and insects?
Well, I mean, you know, it's still under 30. We're not going to lengths like they have in Canada or they have in other very warm tropical places. I mean, many of our animals, our mammals, for example, are nocturnal and they come out at night when it's much cooler. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that'll be the case continually. Things like badgers, things like hedgehogs, they come out at night and it's always cooler at night. So, it, I mean, for them, it probably won't make too much of a difference. Things like squirrels are a daytime creature, things like deer, but, you know, they have enough wit to shelter away. The squirrels are in the trees where you've got leaves and shade, and your deer are in areas where there's woodland as well too. It's things like slugs and snails that are going to be in trouble in a way, I suppose, because they need wet conditions in order to be able to slide along the grass. When the weather breaks now and we have a drop of rain and you go out to your garden, the place will be covered in snails and slugs that were holed up and with their cells sealed up waiting for the weather to break. So if you, a prolonged spell of dry weather probably would reduce the numbers of those. But I can't see people out crying if there's no slugs. Can you, Ray?
Aina Nilauna from The Ray Darcy Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, breakthrough findings into a childhood cancer.
Scientists in Trinity College Dublin have discovered a genetic mutation which causes incurable childhood cancer and have managed to reverse its effects by slowing cancer cell growth in the lab. And I'm joined now on the line by Professor Adrian Bracken from the Department of Genetics at Trinity College Dublin, who led the research. Good morning, Professor Bracken.
Good morning, Claire.
Thank you for joining us. Can you tell us first of all about this particular childhood cancer that you've been working on?
Yes, so it's a devastating cancer. It occurs in young children, so usually less than 10 years of age. And unfortunately, it's not curable. It's a brain cancer and it's called diffuse midline glioma.
And how many children are affected by this in Ireland every year?
Typically 5 to 10. I'm told by our consultant colleagues that so far already 8 children have been diagnosed this year.
And it's a devastating diagnosis.
Absolutely. This is one of the cancers where the doctors are upset when they see families coming in with children with this disease.
Oh gosh. And will you talk us through what you've uncovered then, Adrian, about this particular type of cancer?
So about 3 years ago, we were funded by the Worldwide Cancer Research Organization and Brain Tumor Charity in the UK to study it. And what we did was we studied the gene that causes the cancer. So this is called an oncogene. And it happens that as geneticists, we're interested in the biology of that particular gene. And we set up systems in the lab to study how it works. And ultimately, we figured out how it causes the cancer. So how it blocks normal cells maturing in the brain. And so in doing that, what it does is it causes the cancer. So the normal cells don't mature into functional brain cells and then they continue to grow as a cancer. But in doing that work, the good news, I suppose, is that we found it's one of its two Achilles heels. So it's a weakness that this cancer has, and we were able to exploit that. We came up with a few candidate drugs, and we treated our model system, and we're able to figure out that one particular drug is very effective.
So what happens next, Adrian?
Yeah, so our paper came out yesterday, and there's a lot of excitement about the paper, and the guys in my lab, and I should make sure to acknowledge the guys in the lab, they're a wonderful team, they're still working on their next paper. You know, we've new, and we will have new papers figuring out more about this particular disease, but in terms of what we did yesterday and that paper, we passed the baton on now to the oncologists. And what we'd say is
We feel that EZH2 inhibitors, so they're a particular type of drug, should be put into clinical trials right around the world to treat this disease.
Okay. And you think that should happen in short order, immediately?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm a scientist, geneticist. I'm not an oncologist. And, you know, obviously the trained oncologist will have, you know, complications to figure out, ethical approvals and so on. But certainly from a scientific perspective, this is the most effective drug for this particular cancer because it specifically targets the function of the oncogene.
And we should say that this process, whatever happens next, it's going to take years. It's really good news, but these things take time to reach a point where it might be in use.
Absolutely. I mean, typically, you know, clinical trials take some time even to get going. You know, we saw in the last year, clinical trials for the vaccine, they were really, really quick. But normally it's not that quick. But with this particular disease, you would hope that the oncologist will get trials going in the next year. And it could be a few years, as you said, before we find out, is this an effective treatment?
Adrian Bracken from TCD's School of Genetics and Microbiology, from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon, and Carol called Joe.
My situation, if I could just briefly give you a background to things. My husband and I were both from working class background. My father was a grave digger. My husband's father was he worked for a builder. We didn't come from money. So the only way we were going to get on in life was to work very hard for it. And we have done. My husband's a barman. He worked all his life, the longest hours you could believe. And oftentimes I was on my own. I worked in a school. We didn't get anything handed to us, but at the same time, we didn't take anything that didn't belong to us.
Mm-hmm.
Our life is simple, very simple, and our money, the majority of our money was spent in education for our children because we wanted them to have a good life and wanted to give them the best that we could manage. Our burglary happened a few years back, and unlike other burglaries that happen when people are not in the home, we were all in bed asleep, myself, my husband and our three children. And we were woken up by a voice calling up our stairs. Is there anyone here? And it was the guards.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been contacted by a milkman who'd noticed the door was open.
Okay.
And there's no lights on. And they actually told us that we had been broken into. We didn't even know. Now, they'd taken such a lot of stuff. It was hard to imagine how they could have done it all without making a noise. They took my handbag, and in it were my engagement ring, my wedding ring, my watch from my husband. We were devastated by this. We wouldn't hurt anyone. We wouldn't do anything to anybody. Our life is simple, and we consider other people for everything, in everything we do. And it's a sad thing when somebody feels that it's their given right to walk into a house whenever they feel like it, take whatever they want. And, you know, insurance is great, but it doesn't bring back the feeling I had on my wedding day.
Yeah.
That's Carol on the live line with Joe Duffy. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.